I'm Junie Burke with the Association for Psychological Science, and I'm here today with the lead author of the paper Revisiting the Suffixing Preference, Native Language Affixation Patterns Influence Perception of Sequences, Alexander Martin. Thank you so much for joining me today, Alex.
Yes, I'm very glad to be here. My name is Alexander Martin, and I'm a researcher at the Centre for Language Evolution at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. My research focuses on trying to understand why languages tend to share certain properties or not share other properties or lack certain properties. And I typically look specifically at how the way we learn and use language can influence the way languages change or evolve over time.
So before we jump in, could you summarize the main takeaway of your paper for me?
The study that we did focused on this thing called the suffixing preference. It's been known for a long time that suffixes, those bits that we add to the ends of words, like the plural s in girls, it's been known that suffixes are more common across languages than prefixes. And there's been this sort of commonly held idea that this reflects a general property of human cognition. Specifically, the idea was put forward that we tend to prefer suffixes, or suffixes are more common, because the beginnings of words are actually really important during speech. And I mean, that makes a lot of sense. As we're listening to speech, we try and identify words, and we hear the beginnings of words, and that's an important way that we begin to recognize what that word is. But from the experimental point of view, all of the studies that have aimed to test this idea have been conducted in English or closely related languages. The problem with that is English itself uses more suffixes than prefixes. So it's not really surprising that English-speaking participants, for example, in an experiment, would prefer suffixes over prefixes. They spent their whole lives speaking a language where that's the case. So my co-author, Jennifer Culbertson, and I have been working with a population in Kenya for the last couple of years who speak a language that's sort of the opposite of English in that it has a lot of prefixing compared to suffixing. So it's sort of the ideal test case for checking if the idea that the suffixing preference is really driven by some general aspect of cognition. If it's true that it is a general feature of cognition, we should expect that speakers of Kedaraka would have similar preferences to speakers of English, despite the differences between the two languages.
So tell me a little bit more about what led you to this study. What led you to research prefixes and suffixes, specifically by focusing, I'm going to butcher this, Kedaraka speakers.
Yeah. Kedaraka, yeah. So like I said, my co-author Jenny Culbertson and I have been working with this language, Kedaraka, for a couple of years. And Kedaraka and languages that are related to it are actually a really nice contrast to English in that the language has more prefixes than suffixes. So it's sort of the perfect opportunity to test this hypothesis with a more representative sample. This is a phenomenon, the suffixing preference, that's been known for a long time, and there has been research done on it. But from the experimental point of view, we've focused a little bit too much on these English-speaking populations. This was really an opportunity to test this hypothesis with a more representative sample.
So just for all the researchers out there, what was it like working with speakers of Kedaraka versus English?
Working with Kedaraka was a really great experience for me because we were working with community members, specifically with collaborators that we have there. Working with Kedaraka has been a great experience for me because I'm not a speaker of Kedaraka, and that has meant engagement with the Kedaraka speaking community in Kenya. So we have two main collaborators, Peter Muriungi and Patrick Kanampu, who have really facilitated our work there. We're working on another project with them there, and they've sort of helped us set up this experiment and train research assistants who are local, who are members of the community, and who went out into villages and ran our experiment for us. So it's been really, really impressive for me to go to Kenya, work with these local people, and develop this research project alongside them.
Of course, yes. I think that's a great example of something that makes your paper very unique and that you touch upon, and that's this diversity that has up till now been lacking in language research.
I'll add that we've been collaborating with Patrick and Peter on a different project, and so this project broke off of that, and we sort of took advantage of the fact that we were there. Through working with them, Patrick, for example, who started out as a research assistant for us, has now gotten a scholarship to come and do a PhD at the University of Edinburgh, and it'll be really exciting to sort of be able to continue this work with community members who will be able to return and work with their own community rather than sort of us going to Kenya and working with them.
So tell me, what surprised you most about this study?
So I think the thing that struck me most about this study was it really highlighted for me just how important it is to test our hypotheses in diverse populations. I mean, it's very common in psycholinguistics to make general hypotheses about human nature, but we tend to only test them in sort of very narrow populations, which more often than not is English-speaking undergrads. That makes a lot of sense as a start, right? So many researchers work in North America or Europe on campuses where the most accessible population is an undergraduate population of mostly English speakers or speakers of Spanish and French and related languages. The problem is that if we don't break out of our bubble, if we don't go beyond those populations, we risk missing an opportunity to test just how generalizable our hypotheses are. And so I think we need to be sort of wary of the ease of navel gazing in academia, of looking too much into ourselves and focusing on what is sort of immediately around us. We can start with what we know, but I think stopping there can prevent us from forming accurate explanations for why languages are the way they are. I mean, I think in linguistics, actually, we're very lucky. There are huge communities of scholars in linguistics who are experts on a wide range of languages and who have done years and years of work documenting and understanding linguistic diversity. Especially on the experimental side, we need to think about working harder to take advantage of what we know, take advantage of all the knowledge that we've accrued in theoretical and descriptive linguistics in order to better understand language, in order to figure out where best to target our experimental tests.
You touched on a lot of different themes that I think connect to this next question. You mention in your paper the concept of these weird languages. Let's talk a little bit about why you think, and you've kind of answered this a little bit already, but let's define weird languages and why they've been the focus in the past.
We talk about in the article this term weird, which is an acronym for Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. These societies that we in the language research community tend to be part of, and certainly where most experimental linguistics is taken out. It's sort of obvious that we run our experiments and we test our hypotheses in populations that we have access to, which if we look immediately around us are all of these sort of weird populations. And those are only five dimensions of what defines our population. There's also the linguistic differences and things like that, you know, the properties of the languages themselves that are different. The whole point is that we start by looking at what's around us, but if what we aim to do as academics is better understand the world, we need to make sure that we're studying a representative sample. And weird languages, languages spoken in the West, are not the full picture of languages in the world.
So accessibility doesn't necessarily mean that it's a reflection of everywhere, right? Of universality.
Right.
That being said, I think I was definitely attracted to this universality theme. I think I really value the idea of a broad conclusion. I think I find that that's honestly easier to consume. So it was easy for me, especially from our past discussions, to make this broad conclusion that language shapes how you see the world and vice versa. But this, as we've discussed before, isn't exactly what your paper reveals. Tell me, what are the implications of your study on human cognition?
There's this long-held hypothesis in language research that the language or languages that we speak shapes how we view the world or our perception. In some very specific ways, that's true. So when we think about the way babies acquire their native language, for example, when they're acquiring their native language, they're learning the sounds of their language. And with time, babies and infants become less sensitive to differences, sound differences that aren't used in their native language, right? And they're focusing in on the ones that are used in their native language. And that means that as adults, we can often have a hard time perceiving sound differences in languages that we don't speak. Our native language, a language that we learned when we were young, influences the way that we focus on these specific things, which is linguistic sounds. That's an example of language shaping the way that we perceive language, not the world per se. And I think we're looking at a really similar case of that in our study. What we're showing is that in this task, which is comparing sequences, which is something that's sort of language-like, especially when you have syllables, as one of our conditions does, it's sort of like comparing words to one another. And that's a linguistic exercise. So it makes sense that the language that you learned growing up is going to influence the way that you do that task. This is an example of language influencing language perception. But that's a far cry from showing that language shapes the way you see the world. And I think it's really more about these specific tasks that are related to language itself. What our study highlights is that not necessarily all properties of language reflect shared cognitive biases. In this case, we probably have to look beyond sequence perception, which is, you know, a very attractive explanation, if we're going to explain why suffixes are more common than prefixes in the world's languages.
you used sequences in syllables and sequences in shapes. You found, essentially, whether or not humans prefer suffixes or prefixes determines how they perceive similarity in these two specific areas, visual and audio.
That's right.
What might some explanations be for this world preference for suffixes over prefixes?
Moving past our specific experiment and this idea of sequence perception as driving the suffixing preference, the question of what it is that explains best the preponderance of suffixes compared to prefixes in the world's languages is still a bit of an open question. It's probably not one single thing that drives suffixes to be more common. And it likely has to do with individual languages' histories and evolution. I mean, one hypothesis has to do with how we break up speech, where we add words like and er, and we have those pauses. For example, in English, other languages, many suffixes are derived from what used to be independent words. So if you think of the phrase, I will call you later, we can shorten that word will and say, I'll call you later, right? Mm-hmm. So what was an independent word appears to be a suffix. And over time, we can see how this word will could transform into only being a suffix, ul, right? And we're kind of watching that happen in English right now. But so why would that then lead to more suffixes than prefixes? One hypothesis that's been put forward is that it could have something to do with where in sentences we're likely to make what are called prosodic breaks, which could be small pauses or pauses that are filled with these sounds like and er. Basically, these breaks are less likely to happen between words like I and will. So those words, I and will, could over time fuse together. Whereas if you think of a phrase like, I went to school 3 days ago, it seems totally fine to put a pause between the words to and school and say something like, I went to school 3 days ago, for example. Those common pauses, so those breaks between the word to and the word that follows it, could sort of block to from ever fusing with the next word and becoming a prefix. On the other hand, if you think of that same phrase, the I went to school 3 days ago phrase, if you try and put a break between the words days and ago, you get something very unnatural. If you say something like, I went to school 3 days ago, that's kind of weird, and that doesn't tend to happen. The lack of breaks between words like days and ago in that case could explain why words like ago could more easily fuse with the words that precede them, right? So because we don't tend to break it up there, and we say it as one sort of days ago, means that over time, that word could potentially fuse with words that precede it. If we look at other languages, this type of thing happens. What's interesting and potentially an additional challenge is explaining how prefixes evolve, because after all, there are plenty of prefixes, and some languages like Kibaraka, although they're rarer, do use a lot of prefixes. One interesting avenue that has been explored in past research is the fact that the common prefixes in Kibaraka aren't really words like to or ago. They actually mark what we call noun class. So they identify what kind of noun we're talking about. So if you take the phrase, these two beautiful girls in Kibaraka, you say, are ba 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 ire ba donge, you have this repetition of this sound ba, right? Are ba 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 ire ba donge, which is actually a prefix on the words these two and beautiful. It identifies what noun class the word girls belongs to. And so it's likely that the meanings of the prefixes and suffixes influence how common they are as prefixes or suffixes. We can't see this specific phenomenon in English because English doesn't have noun classes, but when we look at a language that looks differently, we see this different phenomenon. And I think this is another example of why it's important to look beyond English and related languages, because they don't really give us the full picture.
I think you're hitting upon some areas that could be potential studies in the future.
Absolutely. This idea of prosodic breaks was explored in a paper in 2014, and they looked at what we call corpora, big collections of transcribed conversation and text and things like that, and looked at where those pauses happened in a couple of different languages. But it would be really interesting to take that knowledge that's been developed in theoretical linguistics and turn it into an experiment and test it in diverse populations, for sure. I mean, there are just tons of avenues of future research. It's an exciting project, for sure.
Of course, yes. And it sounds like you're making a really big contribution. I mean, we talked about the implications of your study, but I think by opening a door into a diverse population, you are contributing to what the foundation should be of language research. So incredible work.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yes. These are all the questions I have. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I think it's been, you know, a really rewarding experience, and it's something that I've really enjoyed working on this project in Kenya with this community, and it's really helped me solidify some collaborations with people there, and we have some co-authored work coming out hopefully next year. I'm very excited to continue working on this project.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been great. Thank you very much.